This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with Andrew Morantz, New Yorker staff writer. Hi.
Hey.
So, earlier in the show, we talked about how John Stuart Mill's harm principle stipulates that my right to throw a punch ends at the tip of your nose. Here's another clip of John Powell speaking at UC Berkeley, questioning Mill's assumption that there's a clear line between physical and psychological harm.
John Stuart Mill was brilliant, but this is the point that I want to make. He was wrong. What we've learned over the last 40 years in the mind science is that many psychological harms, from the brain's perspective, are almost indistinguishable from what we think of as physical harms. And in fact, the body is not neatly divided. So when you have a psychological shock, you have a physical reaction. When you have a physical shock, you have a psychological reaction. The law is actually struggling with that.
But you spoke to Susan Torres Harding. She's a professor at psychology at Roosevelt University, and she studies exactly this sort of thing.
She's saying that when people experience the effects of racism on a daily basis, it affects their physical bodies. They experience hypertension, chronic diseases, even lower birth rates.
Race in itself is a completely made-up category. There's no kind of biological indicator to it. But if people act like it's true, then it can have very real serious consequences on people's health, on people's life chances. Over a lifetime, we expect that those effects may add up, like any other kind of chronic stressor.
Many conservatives are nervous about that because it's like, well, if we acknowledge that, where does it end? If we start recognizing implicit bias, we start recognizing psychological harms, it will radically change society. And it would. And it should.
When Powell talked about that, it reminded me of this other case where the judges were worried about unraveling the whole system underneath the case they were looking at. So there was this case called McCleskey versus Kemp in 1987. And the Supreme Court had to consider whether the death penalty was being disproportionately applied against black offenders. And they found that it wasn't. But in a dissenting opinion, Brennan, one of the justices, he said that their finding wasn't based on data. It was based on what he called a fear of too much justice.
Because the data would show that, of course, the death penalty was disproportionately affecting black defendants.
Yeah, that data was presented to the court. And Brennan was basically saying, the rest of my colleagues don't want to look at this because they're afraid of what it would mean.
What would it mean?
Well, if the death penalty is racist, then maybe the whole criminal justice system is racist. And that they don't want to do that work of undoing the entire system they've built.
Hmm.
And there's kind of an analogy here to free speech, right? What Powell is saying is, if we really took the 14th Amendment seriously,
equal protection,
full citizenship, it might undo all the work we've done to interpret the First Amendment the way we have. So we kind of just don't want to look at it.
So Powell says the judges are worried that we're going to have to rethink our whole approach to free speech, maybe pass more laws restricting it like they have in Europe.
That idea worries a lot of people, including P.E. Moskowitz. Even though Moskowitz wrote a book called The Case Against Free Speech, Moskowitz, they're actually arguing against more laws restricting speech like they have in Europe.
Because why?
Because Moskowitz does not trust the government.
More often than not, those laws are used to just limit speech that the government doesn't like. I know in France, for example, there have been a couple times where their anti-Semitism law has been used to clamp down on pro-boycott, divest, sanctioned speech, which, you know, I think is a legitimate form of speech. And as a Jew, not one that I find inherently anti-Semitic.
So obviously not everyone agrees with that way of talking about the BDS movement. But the point is, free speech restrictions, when they get weaponized, they can be weaponized by the left or by the right. Susan Benesch, who's the director of the Dangerous Speech Project, she does not want to get rid of this Brandenburg standard, the standard that says that all speech is permitted unless it incites imminent physical violence. Even she wants to keep that standard in place because she thinks it might even create more problems than it would solve.
I'm quite skeptical that law, especially criminal law, is a useful tool to control speech. When people are prosecuted for hate speech, for example, in other countries where hate speech is a crime, the prosecution publicizes them and their speech, and they end up with even more followers than before they were prosecuted.
She also said that We need to remember, Brandenburg only applies in public spaces. And
right.
We live our lives in a lot of private spaces. You know, workplaces, universities, even online spaces that are built by private companies. So the First Amendment doesn't apply there in the same way. And Benesch thinks that a lot in those spaces can be achieved by shifting norms rather than shifting laws.
What is the likelihood that an American politician will use the N-word knowing that the microphone is on? The likelihood is very tiny because that person will then lose that election. The person will be punished, not by law, but in another way.
The norms that were supposed to keep a troll from winning a presidential election didn't quite work in 2016, did it?
Definitely true. I think she's making a more minimalist point there, that even though Trump is a troll, even he understands he's not supposed to say the N-word in public, at least
at the time of this recording.
Right, exactly. So this goes back to what I was saying about Richard Rorty.
The philosopher you talked about at the beginning of the hour, who believes there is no arc of history that's going to deliver us towards justice, that everything is possible and that our future turns on contingencies.
Exactly. So his whole thing was that the way history moved forward was that people, they don't just change laws or tweak this or that idea. Their beliefs and behaviors have to change at a really deep, fundamental level. Their assumptions that they hold without even being able to articulate them often. And those assumptions, when those assumptions change, we can change things that used to be considered quite strange, and those can just become normal, or vice versa. And the deepest social norms, the assumptions that we carry around that we don't even always think about consciously, for him, he referred to those as vocabularies.
Assumptions on which we build our view of ourselves and our nation.
Our behavior, everything. They're so core to us that we don't even articulate them. And so when we hear norms, we think like etiquette or politesse or whatever, but it's really much deeper than that.
Yeah, but right now we're all really worried about, you know, the new normal. How did we get down here so fast? And how do we climb out and reach for a less rageful, less ugly vocabulary, as you'd say?
Yeah.
Benesch says that the Germans sunk really fast into Nazism and climbed out of it quickly, too, although admittedly it had the foot of the Allies on their neck.
Right. And it might be that the acuteness of the crisis is related to how quickly you build your way out. Luckily, we've never had a crisis that bad.
And she says we're not there yet.
She says we're not there yet. So our rebuilding is likely to be more slow and gradual. And we've seen examples of this. You know, we had a civil rights movement. We had a women's movement. More recently, we had a marriage equality movement. These social norms can change. We've seen it happen in our lifetimes. And at first, you know, it seems really scary to certain people. They can't imagine abiding by it. And pretty quickly, they integrate it into their vocabularies, and it becomes a thing they take for granted.
It sounds so easy. All we have to do is interrogate a few assumptions that have led us to this moment and maybe get rid of some, right?
Exactly. Piece of cake. So, I mean, we can start thinking about how to chip away at it, right? We can drop that view we talked about earlier that the arc of history will just naturally deliver us where we need to go. We can drop our view of American exceptionalism, that we are this shining city on a hill. We could just, you know, be a little more humble.
At the beginning of the hour, you alluded to an essay that Rorty wrote in 1996 called Looking Backward from the Year 2096. And he envisioned a dark age, beginning in 2014, a kind of Margaret Atwood-y autocracy in which our cherished rights and our freedoms, they all implode in a kind of orgy of violence and chaos. And then he imagines us climbing out of that hole and starting to rebuild. And he was a little light on the details when it came to how we did that.
It's true. It's all sort of general and speculative. But I think the closest he comes to imagining the specifics is when he talks about getting away from focusing on individual rights, the John Stuart Mill stuff, the where I can swing my fists and where the tip of your nose is, getting away from that framework and shifting to a framework about fraternity and social compacts and solidarity.
And so, listeners, we've pulled a few paragraphs from Rorty's speculative essay so we can hear it in his words. You start.
All right. Our long, hesitant, painful recovery over the last five decades from the breakdown of democratic institutions during the dark years, 2014 to 2044, has changed our political vocabulary, as well as our sense of the relation between the moral order and the economic order. Just as 20th century Americans had trouble imagining how their pre-Civil War ancestors could have stomached slavery, so we, at the end of the 21st century, have trouble imagining how our great-grandparents could have legally permitted a CEO to get 20 times more than her lowest-paid employees.
That is a really big shift from where we are now.
Big shift. It's also kind of quaint that he thought 20 times more was so obscene. But yeah, so you can see how for Rorty, the whole game, it's not about replacing one law or even replacing one government with another. It's about replacing the whole framework, right? So we're not doing the individual rights thing anymore. We're changing out our whole discourse for a new one.
He says, how to formulate a principle of fraternity. Fraternity is an inclination of the heart, one that produces a sense of shame at having much when others have little. It's not the sort of thing that anybody can have a theory about or that people can be argued into having.
You just arrive at that new vocabulary. It's not winning or losing an argument.
Yeah. And he talks about humility. The America that he describes at the end of this century, we're no longer an economic powerhouse, and we no longer believe that's our destiny. He wrote, we are citizens of an isolationist, unambitious, middle-grade nation. Our products are only now becoming competitive again in international markets, and politicians continue to urge that our consistently low productivity is a small price to pay for union control of the workplace and worker ownership of the majority of firms.
Make America middle grade again. So he continues, American exceptionalism did not survive the dark years. We no longer think of ourselves as singled out by divine favor. We are now, once again, a constitutional democracy, but we have proved as vulnerable as Germany, Russia, and India to dictatorial takeovers.
We have a sense of fragility, of susceptibility to the vicissitudes of time and chance, which Walt Whitman and John Dewey may never have known. But our chastened mood, our lately learned humility, may have made us better able to realize that everything depends on keeping our fragile sense of American fraternity intact. So, Rorty believes there's no way to force people to feel empathy.
Right. So as I was talking about earlier, part of what he thought was broken about the Enlightenment framework was that you can't just throw more speech into the mix. If the conversational framework is broken, you can't just compete with more and more noise. You have to change the framework itself. And it's a chicken and egg thing, I should acknowledge. You know, in order to change the society, you have to change the vocabulary. In order to change the vocabulary, you have to change the society.
Yeah, I don't know. It just sounds literally like wishful thinking.
You know, this is how a guy who was an analytical philosopher starts writing utopian sci-fi fiction. He actually believed that in order to make a better world, you have to start by just making one up.
And he starts by imagining a horrific dark age?
In his version of the imagined future of America, we have to hit rock bottom before we start building our way back up.
And so this is what passes for hope for you, Andrew?
I did tell you before, I'm the guy who thinks our institutions are not deserving of any real faith and that we might be teetering on the brink of democratic collapse at any moment. So from me right now, this is probably as close to optimism as you're going to get.
I'll take it. Andrew Marantz, New Yorker staff writer and author of Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Thanks for the hour.
Absolutely. It was fun.
The That's it for this week's show, which was produced almost single-handedly by Micah Loewinger. Our show is also produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chattavetti. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show is edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. Thanks again to New Yorker staff writer Andrew Marantz. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.